The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 324, Pandemonium in Paradise, Oahu, 1853, a paper by Scott Kenny, with comments by Ken Cannon.
It's quite annoying if you ever bought any of the tapes, you know, you have to wait and wait and wait for the beginning of a session. The speaker's not working? You don't hear me? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. My name is Richard Castleton, and it's my privilege to welcome you here to this session of Sunstone. Our speaker today, of course, as you know, is Scott Kenny. To some of you newcomers, you may not know the significance of Scott's contribution to Sunstone, and I'd just like to mention it. Scott was the founder and publisher and editor of Sunstone, and probably... I think has contributed as much to Sunstone as we know it today as anyone has. And we appreciate what Scott has done. For those of you who may be new and may have missed some of Scott's early things, may I suggest that you try, if you're a computer user, that you get, I think you can get them now for $10, the whole set of Sunstone tapes where you can easily look up I think many are, if not all, up till a couple of years ago, the talks and writings that Scott has given us. Scott was received his BA and MA in music at the University of Utah, after which he worked on his doctoral at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Scott was a member of the University of Utah. At present, he is editor, I believe, for Word Perfect, and manual writer. We're very fortunate to have Ken Cannon as our responder. And Ken has a very extensive impressive biographical list here. Scott got his BA and MA in history at the BYU, after which he pursued his and got his Juris Doctorate at the BYU. He then received a Fulbright scholarship. He is presently a partner with LaBeouf, Lamb, Green, and McRae in practicing law. He has numerous publications, too numerous to mention here. It's the first time I've had the privilege of meeting Ken. I'm looking forward, as you are, to hearing from Scott.
John Milton coined the name Pandemonium for the capital city of hell in Paradise Lost. In Pandemonium, Satan convenes a grand council of fallen angels to settle on a new course of action. Molech calls for a direct assault on heaven. Belial and Mammon counsel peace. Hell isn't such a bad place after all. But Beelzebub shifts the focus to God's new creation, the happy seat of some new race called man. By force or subtlety, he proposes, let us waste his whole creation, or possess all as our own, and drive as we were driven the puny inhabitants. Or if not drive, seduce them to our party, that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works. This would surpass common revenge, and our joy upraise in his disturbance, when his darling sons, hurled headlong to partake with us, shall curse their frail, original, and fated bliss, fated so soon. The bold design pleased highly those infernal states, and joy sparkled in all their eyes. With full assent, they adopt the plan, earth with hell to mingle. His kingdom united, Satan flies toward earth, but at the gates of hell he is confronted by death, who refuses to let him pass. Unknown to each other, the two prepare to battle until sin intervenes, reminding Satan of times in heaven when such joy thou tookst with me in secret that my womb conceived a growing burden. After the war in heaven, sin had been banished to the gates of hell, commanded to keep them closed forever. And there she sat alone, till my womb, pregnant by thee, and now excessive grown, prodigious motion felt and rueful throes. At last, sin gave birth to her odious offspring, Satan's own begotten, death. Unruffled by the news, Smooth Satan replies, "Dear daughter, fair son, I came no enemy but to set free from out this dark and dismal house of pain both him and thee, and all the heavenly host of spirits that fell with us from on high. Open the gates," he urges in, "and he will take her to the place where thou and death shall dwell at ease. There ye shall be fed and filled immeasurably. All things shall be your prey." Death grins a ghastly smile. Sin unlocks the gate, and all the powers of hell rush through to waste God's whole creation, or drive as we were driven, or if not drive, seduce, that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works. The Hawaiian Islands were not the Garden of Eden, even prior to 1778. Satan had already been there. War was frequent. Kings and chiefs, descendants of the gods, owned all the land and imposed burdensome taxes on the people. They declared taboos at will and executed transgressors. Priests presided over temple rituals that included mutilation and human sacrifice. Still, it seemed the gods smiled on this island paradise. Sweet potato, banana, and taro were easily cultivated, and fish abounded in the sea. Koa trees provided logs for canoes, pili grass and tea leaves for thatch. Life expectancy was higher than in Europe. But in 1778, Captain James Cook opened wide the gates of hell. Sin manifests herself in new forms, and death poured out vials of disease never before seen. Syphilis first, then tuberculosis, cholera, leprosy, measles, and influenza. The Hawaiian immune systems were defenseless. From 1778 to 1853, native population plummeted from 800,000 to little more than 70,000, a drop of 90% in just 75 years. International trade obliterated the sandalwood forests. Foreigners ignored taboos, undermining traditional religion. Merchants sold brightly colored cottons and silks in Honolulu, and those who could afford them quickly abandoned traditional dress. Saloons flourished, and alcoholism became common, especially in the royal family. As natives mimicked foreign manners, Hawaiian culture unraveled. The first whaling ships appeared in Hawaiian waters in 1819, and Honolulu became the whaling capital of the world. Hundreds of ships stopped annually for repairs and supplies, and for the crews, rest, relaxation, and the release of pent-up passion. Venereal disease ravaged Honolulu and Lahaina. Infertility rose, and the annual death rate soon surpassed the birth rate. For example, in 1853, the year of our focus, there were 8,000 deaths in Hawaii compared to 1,500 births. Women miscarried or gave birth to sickly children, then began the long, painful descent to a grotesque, hellish death. 1819 was also the year Kamehameha I died. On his deathbed, he forbade the traditional human sacrifices performed at the king's death, and a few months later his son abolished the taboo system. The temples were destroyed, idols burned. There was little opposition. Without a unifying myth, without a connection to their ancestors, Hawaiians lost their spiritual compass. Into this vacuum, the very next year, stepped Presbyterian and Congregational ministers. The first wave arrived on April 4, 1820. Missionaries translated, printed, and distributed the Bible. They established elementary schools throughout the islands, and on Maui founded the Lahaina Luna High School. From 1837 to 1840, 20,000 natives were baptized, and Hawaii was officially declared Christian. Protestant missionaries remained on the islands an average of 23 years. The king granted them land for homes, schools, and church, kitty-corner from his palace. The college-educated missionaries became key advisors to the king. Under their influence, legislation was passed banning the hula and other traditions. They required strict observance of the Sabbath, even prohibiting the kindling of fires on that day. Protestants had been on the island 30 years before the Mormons arrived in late 1850. At first, the Mormons directed their efforts toward the foreign merchants in Honolulu and Lahaina. But these folks had little interest in Mormonism. Some were positively hostile. So in March of 1851, George Buchanan struck out on his own to travel among the natives on Maui. He soon won the affection of an English-speaking landowner, Jonathan H. Napella, who became Cannon's chief ally. Napella and his two friends, K.H. Kaliohana and William Ua'ua, formed the Mormon nucleus on Maui. All three were English-speaking graduates of Lahaina Luna. Ua'ua was also a lawyer and a gifted speaker. This influential trio introduced Cannon to others and translated for him. Through them, he told the people about the Book of Mormon, a sacred record of their ancestors. Hawaiians were descendants of the House of Israel, God's chosen people. When he preached the Book of Mormon, Cannon reported, tears flowed down their cheeks like little children. Old Testament prophets, Cannon taught, prophesied that the Book of Mormon would usher in the kingdom of God on earth, and in that new kingdom, Hawaiians would have an exalted station. As exciting as these doctrines were, nothing attracted Hawaiians more than the news that Mormons could heal the sick. The natives astonished the elders with their faith, and reports of healing spread like wildfire. The lame walked, the blind saw, even the dead were raised. Cannon and his colleagues were soon baptizing almost daily. Usually it took just one sermon. Quick baptism appealed to Hawaiians, for Protestants required 5 or 6 months of probation. The downside, of course, was that the baptisms didn't usually take. New members were easily intimidated by former ministers and often returned to the Protestant fold. On Maui, Elder Thomas Keeler wrote, "There is a great falling away of the brethren and sisters." A few months later, on Oahu, William Farrer lamented, "The brethren and sisters here mostly begin to waver, and many have already left the church and gone to the Calvinistic church. They appear to be leaving about as fast as they came in." An important exception was Farrer's first convert, J.W.H. Ka'uahi. Ka'uahi was another English-speaking graduate of Lahaina Luna, a lawyer, and a member of the legislature. He studied Mormonism for 3 months before accepting baptism, and instantly became the most effective Mormon preacher on Oahu. By October 1852, Ka'uahi and Farrer had baptized 75. Though on Maui, Cannon and Keeler, Napella, Ua'ua, Kaliohano, and others baptized nearly 1,000. 9 new elders arrived in February 1853. Benjamin Math Johnson, Thomas Karen, and Nathan Tanner were assigned to Oahu, joining William Farrer, Henry Bigler, and Mission President Philip B. Lewis. Lewis spent most of his time working as a tinsmith. He could not speak the language. Without English-speaking teachers, Hawaiian seemed an almost insurmountable barrier. Henry Bigler still could not understand Hawaiian speakers, though he had been on the islands over 2 years. "Sometimes I ask some of the brethren to speak and express their feelings. Today I asked Brother Ka'iamanu to the Smith's meeting, and his talk was like a streak of lightning running down a pole, that I could not tell head or tail of it, and did not know whether to say amen or not. Though, like the old man I once heard of, I said amen to venture." The newcomers were easily discouraged. After less than 2 months on the islands, Tanner was deeply discouraged, Johnson was sad and disheartened, and Karen was nearly in despair. Fortunately, about that time, William Ua'ua arrived. A faithful member and for nearly a year and a half, Ua'ua was now an experienced missionary. And because he spoke English, Tanner's and the others could talk with him. On Sunday, April 10th, Ua'ua preached his first Honolulu sermon. Three were baptized the next morning. Immediately, Tanner saw the future. "All the foreign elders will have to do hereafter will be to instruct the native elders in principles, they having the power of their own language. And I now think if I can be able to teach them the principles of truth, they can teach it to the balance of the nation." The following Sunday, Ua'ua spoke to a packed audience, and three more were baptized, followed by 5 on Monday, 6 on Tuesday, and 2 on Wednesday. Some of the chiefs are very believing, Tanner rejoiced, and we are encouraging Brother Ua'ua all that we can and instructing him what to do. And he is doing the best he can, enlightening the king and the chiefs. Ua'ua's name, when interpreted, is Rain Rain, but I think he is a perfect thunderstorm and will soon flood these islands with Mormonism. We adopted the policy of ordaining every native that we thought would do any good and instructed them and set them at work in Honolulu and surrounding country. On April 22nd, Ua'ua and Kauahi were ordained elders. Thomas Paku and John W. Kahumaku were ordained priests, and Isaka Kahu'ulua was ordained a teacher. Kahumuku would soon go to Hawaii as spokesman for Tanner and Karen. Kahu'ulua and Paku would become Henry Bigler's spokesman on East Oahu. In just 2 weeks, they would baptize 100 and organize a branch at Kaeoe. On April 24th, Ua'ua's third Sunday in Honolulu, he and Kauahi spoke to a large attentive audience. According to Farrer, the only elder on the island who understood Hawaiian, the Spirit of the Lord was with them, and they spoke with power. The crowd gathered round, and soon after meeting commenced, the house was filled to overflowing and more outside than could get near to hear. That afternoon, Farrer and Kauahi announced their intention to organize a branch and invited all who wished to be baptized to join them at the falls about a mile and a half from town. As the people filed out of the meeting hall, the Presbyterian meeting also broke up. The cry went out, "What's up? What's up? The Mormon's going to baptize." Curious onlookers poured into the street until those in the middle of the throng could not see the end in either direction. At the falls, 1,000 onlookers positioned themselves on the banks around the pool. The proselytes were invited to come forward and give their names. Ua'ua questioned them regarding their faith and their commitment to forsake their sins. Then he instructed them on the nature of the covenants they were about to make. The candidate stepped up to the water's edge and called on the multitude. And he called on the multitude to keep good order while the ordinance was being performed, and called on the people to take off their hats while singing and prayer was attended to. Following the hymn, Ua'ua prayed. Then he and Farrer went down into the water and baptized 39. It was, Farrer wrote, a scene long to be remembered. The Honolulu branch was organized 2 days later with 75 members. After the meeting, 6 more were added, and 3 teachers and 5 deacons were ordained. On the following Sunday, the 1st of May, Ua'ua and Kauahi spoke again, and 43 presented themselves for baptism. Again, a large crowd witnessed the ordinance, while another group listened to Ua'ua's next sermon a quarter of a mile away. 13 requested baptism there, and they too were followed to the water by a large number of people. In the next 12 days, 78 more were added. The baptisms attracted the attention of Reverend Ephraim Clark, and he was not pleased. "One or two Mormon converts from Lahaina Luna have made quite a stir for a week or two past," he reported, "leaving captive silly women and silly men, too laden with divers lust, most of them from the dregs of Honolulu. They have been urged into the water on a sudden excitement, thus turning the solemn ordinance of baptism into a farce." While Ua'ua and Kauahi were doing the preaching, the Utah elders were also in great demand to administer to the sick. Scabies was a common, highly contagious disease caused by mites that produced large festering sores all over the body. As repulsive as scabies was to the Utah elders, however, syphilis was worse and deadly. One doctor described its effects on the islands. "Foul ulcers of many years' standing everywhere abound, and visages horribly deformed, eyes rendered blind, noses entirely destroyed, mouths monstrously drawn aside from their natural position, ulcerating palates and almost useless arms and legs mark most clearly the state and progress of the disease. It is heart-sickening to see the awful effects of the venereal diseases upon this people," Elder Francis Hammond wrote. "They are literally wasting away under its influence." Perhaps it was syphilis Thomas Karen encountered when he was called upon to administer to a man with a sore leg. "It was frightful to look on. It made my heart ache to behold such suffering, to see men and their flesh robbed off their bones, which is the case with many of this people. Such objects of suffering I never before held. be held. Such was the nature of sickness in Honolulu. As for its prevalence and the perception of Mormon power over it, Nathan Tanner's diary entries for 5 consecutive days in May are instructive. May 9th. 5 sick came to us to be healed before breakfast. May 10th. We have had about 15 cases of sick today. I think out of some hundreds of administrations, I only know of 2 cases that have failed to get better, and some of them have been raised up from the lowest and last stage of life that can be found in a filthy, lewd house to health, and lots of them that were half-rotten with their disease. May 11th. We are administering to the sick, lots of sick, coming and going all the time. May 12th. A house full of sick again. One man that had not walked for 6 months walked 3/4 of a mile to be baptized and back again right through the city. The children along the street said the Calvins could not give men legs to walk like Mormons do. May 13th. Was it not for the will of God, and that God did work with us, and for the sake of suffering humanity, we could never do the things that we are doing daily. That day, however, the 13th of May, 1853, the will of God shifted. Smallpox was discovered in a washerwoman and a young girl living 2 blocks from the palace. A smallpox epidemic had never occurred on the islands. Travelers were carefully checked, and isolated cases had been successfully quarantined. This was the first time residents had been diagnosed with the fatal disease. Smallpox was highly infectious, with a high mortality rate. After a 12-day incubation period, patients developed severe headaches and backaches, high fever and chills, followed by a severe rash, a return of the fever, and bacterial infection. Death came by infection of the lungs, heart, or brain. The entire course from infection to death usually took 5 or 6 weeks. The 2 women were taken from their homes and quarantined, their clothing and grass houses burned. Their street was roped off and palace guards placed around the perimeter. The Board of Health declared vaccination mandatory for all inhabitants of the island. Some, fearing the cowpox vaccine almost as much as smallpox, fled to the mountains or sailed for other islands. On Maui, Francis Hammond wrote, "The saints wished to know if they should not go and get vaccinated, as all the people were doing so. I told them if their faith was weak, and they do not trust the Lord, to go. But as for myself, I should not go, and if I died, all was well." We have been preaching that the hour of God's judgments were at hand, Tanner wrote, and the smallpox has borne a faithful testimony to the fact. "Our brethren, they say it is a judgment from the Lord," wrote another, "and they feel the trust in Him. The judge impressed a fine on all that did not get vaccinated of $5. They then was obliged to go and be vaccinated, for they had not the $5 to pay. I have seen them, after they were vaccinated, pick their arm and then suck it with their mouth to get the matter out." But the elders would be subject to heavy fines if convicted of interfering with vaccination. So Lewis directed all the elders and members to comply with the law. Still they resisted. One of the native elders circulated a petition among the saints. "They wanted no medical men near them," Thomas Curran wrote. "All they wanted was the elders of the church to administer to them and pray with them. I never saw as much faith in my life." The epidemic began slowly, only 2 deaths by the 1st of June. But the virus was spreading rapidly. By the 18th of June, 41 had died. In the following week, 38 died. The next week, 189. Still, Ua'ua reported at the end of June, "Very few saints had contracted the pox, and those who have had it all got well by administering to them with oil and prayer, except one who died." If accurate, only one death would have been significant. For now the Mormons numbered 600, and 9 or 10 deaths might have been expected. This apparent success heightened interest in Mormonism, and rumors circulated that members of Reverend Smith's congregation had urged him to do as the Mormons done, telling him that they done like the Bible. He said it was right and went to work and laid his hands on several of them. "So it is with the doctors. They have commenced anointing with oil, saying it is the best cure for the smallpox, seeing the Mormons are very successful in their administrations." William Farrer was less sanguine. Visiting Honolulu in late June, he wrote, "I shall not soon forget the scenes of misery and wretchedness my eyes beheld. The first man we visited was one of our priests and a faithful man by the name of Kamahia. When I left, he was well and healthy to all appearances, but now he was so disfigured with the smallpox that no traces of his countenances were discoverable, and his throat was so stopped up that his voice was scarcely audible. We administered to him and several others. On the 1st of July, Farrer and Lewis returned to check on Brother Kamahia. They were surprised to discover Dr. Lathrop, who advised them Kamahia would probably not live. As they were talking, an Englishman named Charles Turner arrived. Turner, who had been hired by the marshal to help with the epidemic, accused Lewis of causing his mother-in-law's death by telling her to throw out her medicine. He threatened to kill Lewis or any other Mormon caught on his property again. The doctor tried to calm Turner down, and the two left. Turner soon returned, however, with two constables, who warned the elders to stop administering to the sick. The missionaries, ignoring the warning, went to administer to another member. Again, Turner and the constables appeared. Turner attacked Farr, punching him three or four times in the face and chest, then turned on Lewis, threatening to kill him. The elders fled, with Turner on their tail, demanding that they go with him to the prison. Instead, they returned home, and B.F. Johnson filed a complaint on their behalf, charging Turner with assault. He was fined $12. The doctors and constables were frustrated by Mormon obstructions. They were already overworked. Dr. Lathrop reported 568 patients under his care on the 1st of July, and natives were dying without ever seeing a doctor. On top of everything, too late it was discovered that the first batch of vaccine, given to 1,500, was defective. Bodies were discovered in grass houses, in alleys, and on hillsides. Burial squads were overwhelmed. Corpses buried in shallow graves were unearthed and eaten by hogs and dogs. At the hospital, Farrer wrote, the stench was almost unendurable, although the natives in attendance kept burning tar to purify the room. He had difficulty finding the object of his visit, Sister Maka'ina Ina. She had lost so much facial skin as to be almost unrecognizable and was near breathing her last. At the door lay two corpses ready to be carried off to inter, the one in a coffin, the other wrapped up in native mats. The deaths of Sister Maka'ina Ina and Brother Ka'amahi are not specifically mentioned, but we do know that two sisters died on the 1st of July. Kahu Alua, who was ordained an elder on the 6th of July, died of the pox on the 13th. He was, Hammond wrote, much beloved by all the church. He is the first man out of this nation in this generation that has died with the holy priesthood on him. Also dying that day was her brother Nuhi. A teacher, W.D. Umu, was also among the first to die. On July 15th, a sister, Kahumaka, succumbed. The next day, July 16th, a doctor and his assistant called on two households where the elders had administered to the sick. And the first they left medicine and dumped out the Mormon tea. The occupants of the next household told the doctor he was not needed. Warned if they did not get medical attention, they would die, they replied. If they did, it would only be like those who had had the doctors in that neighborhood who had all died. Vaccination was an effective preventative. Even Mormon elders did not dispute that. But once the pox appeared, there was little that medicine or the laying on of hands could do. It was not always fatal. And doctors like missionaries may have attributed recoveries to their intervention. But neither medical nor priesthood arts could reverse death's rampage. A brother No'omana and a few others died the last week of July. Henry Bigler discovered several abandoned houses in Kanaoe. The occupants had all either died or had fled to some other place, leaving everything behind, hogs, dogs, and pets to take care of themselves. In the first week of August, J.W. Opanui, a priest, Makahoe, a deacon, and Aaron a teacher, died. Certainly others died, unknown to the missionaries until several weeks after their deaths occurred. Nevertheless, by late July, it was obvious to everyone that the saints were dying. The Utah elders, their faith unaffected, continued to send glowing reports to Utah. One insisted, the elders were administering to the sick with greatest success, not any of the saints dying who adhered to counsel and attended to the ordinances of the gospel. Farrer was more candid. In his diary, he acknowledged, There is scarcely a day but what someone of the brethren or sisters is dying of this disease. The number of deaths that have come to my knowledge in the district that I have charge of, and which numbered a little rising of 400 when the sickness commenced, is near 100. The death toll continued to climb. Brother Connie Uakela died on August 28th, and I.W. Kahona on the 30th. The next day, Thomas Curran wrote, "When I first landed in February, the streets of Honolulu you would find all crowded all night, and you would hear the sound of instruments and music all over the town with dancing and rowdying of all kinds. But oh, what a change! Travel through the streets now, and you will scarcely meet with a person. It is supposed that about one-third of the inhabitants of this island has died with smallpox. It has taken saint and sinner. I think there is about half of this people that is under the venereal diseases, and when they took the smallpox, they died off like rotten sheep. The saints were surrounded by death. Their meeting house stood in the hardest-hit area of Honolulu. In one small yard near our meeting house, there were 53 persons at the commencement of the disease, 32 of which died. In another small yard, there were 11 taken sick and taken to the hospital, 10 of which died. And many such like cases have occurred, and many houses have been left without inhabitant. While others minimized the effect smallpox had on the saints, Farrer would only say that the Mormon death rate was no higher than the general population. The scourge continued through September and into October. Henry Bigler had attended a conference at Kahului in September. When he returned in November, he found 17 members of the branch had died of the pox. "Elder Ioba and wife are dead," he wrote in his journal. Brother Ioba was the presiding elder of the branch, a man who had influence among the people and among his brethren, and was faithful and died a good man. "I have noticed one thing, and so has my Utah brethren. The death has taken the best members we have on these islands. He has seen fit to take the best elders we have, but perhaps they are taken for a wise purpose in the Lord, as they have the priesthood and may be sent to preach to the spirits in prison as Jesus did." In 5 months, the epidemic was transformed from a scourge of the wicked to a mission call for the righteous. It will never be known how many died that summer. The marshal said nearly 6,000 on Oahu, 30%. In Honolulu, Reverend Lowell Smith lost 375 members, and Reverend Ephraim Clark, 516. Other areas of the island were relatively unaffected, while in Awa, 40% died. There, several months later, Reverend Artemus Bishop reported, "The whole state of society became disorganized. Almost every family was broken up. The Sabbath was not well observed, and few meetings but thinly attended, and immorality prevailed. There is still much apathy prevailing on the subject of religion." The Mormons were similarly affected. Approximately 275 died, a third of all the saints on the island, and survivors were dispirited. Karen observed a cloud of doom hanging over this place. Those crowded and spirited meetings which were carried on here a few months ago has disappeared. Our meetings has in a great measure been broken up. We have had to give up our meeting house. So great has been the destruction among this people that they almost despair of life. Even them that survive. The summer of 1853 was faith-shattering. Those who had joined the church believing the priesthood would protect them and their loved ones were devastated. Shortly before he died, Isaka Kahu'ulua asked to be restored to his position in Reverend Smith's congregation if he survived. His wife declared she would leave Mormonism whether he lived or not. The widows of Opanui and Umu, and doubtless others, also refused to have anything to do with the church after their husbands died. William Ua'ua stopped proselyting in July when meetings were canceled to blunt the spread of the virus, and he left the church a few months after the epidemic ended. We do not know his reasons, but the departure of such a prominent missionary and friend in court must have had a profound impact on the church in Oahu. We have no native diaries or letters, so we cannot accurately assess the extent of disaffection, but we do know that convert baptisms plummeted. From April through July, there had been 750 baptisms, averaging 188 a month. From August to February 1854, the rate dropped to 18 a month. then to 12 a month through July of 1854. From July of 1854 to July of 1855, the rate rose slightly to an average of 20 a month, barely a tenth of the number averaged by Ua'ua, Ka'uahi, Paku, and Kahu'alua in the summer of 1853. But the epidemic was only one cause for the decline of Mormonism on Oahu. Many early converts had joined because the Mormons imposed no financial burden on members, as opposed to the Protestants, who required substantial donations to support missionaries and their families, build homes, build and maintain schools and churches, and even sponsor other missions in the Pacific. When the Mormons introduced tithing in October 1852, many were disillusioned. But that was just the beginning. In October of 1853, as the epidemic was beginning to abate, the elders decided to buy a printing press to publish the Book of Mormon in Hawaiian. They also decided to buy a ship to emigrate the saints to San Bernardino. They borrowed $1,500, due in 12 months. Repayment of the debt, on top of tithing and donations for the ship, and for the return passage of elders Cannon, Farr, Bigler, Caron, and others to California, placed extraordinary demands on the saints, who were in the midst of an economic depression brought on by the epidemic. Incessant pleas for money alienated many. The emigration scheme failed when the ship bought by Nathan Tanner proved unseaworthy and the funds were lost. Then in October 1854, the press arrived. But before it could be set up, it was returned to San Francisco, where George Q. Cannon used it to publish the Western Standard. Cannon did print the Hawaiian Book of Mormon, and it arrived in October 1855. The saints were dismayed to learn that after buying the press, they would also have to buy the books printed on it. Few were purchased. The Utah elders believed if they could gather the saints to an isolated location, they could make real Mormons out of them. A friendly non-Mormon chief granted them the use of land on Lanai, and a few dozen pioneers gathered to build the City of Joseph. Unfortunately, gatherings stripped the branches of their most faithful saints. In their absence, many converts lost interest in the church, and the branches began to fall apart. When the crops failed on Lanai, the colony disbanded, fueling the Mormon credibility problem. Then Ka'uahi, the highest profile saint on the islands and one of Mormonism's most prolific missionaries, left the church. He dated his disenchantment from 1854, right after the epidemic, the decisions to buy a printing press and a ship, and about the same time Ua'ua dropped out. A version of his 1856 letter explaining his reasons for leaving was included in John Hyde's 1857 expose of Mormonism published in Honolulu. Ka'uahi criticized the Utah elders for reversing themselves on tithing and the word of wisdom. He denounced the Book of Mormon, plural marriage, gathering to Utah, and obedience to Brigham Young. Ka'uahi's defection, like the loss of Ua'ua, was a heavy blow to the Mormon cause. Many followed their lead out of the church. Hawaiian membership peaked at 4,200 in July 1855, just before Ka'uahi's defection. At that point, Hawaiians constituted 6% of church membership worldwide. The figure is somewhat misleading, though, for Hawaiians moved about freely and were hard to track down. Many were kept on the rolls, though no one knew where they were or even if they were alive. From mid-1855 through 1857, despite increased numbers of missionaries, membership declined. But instead of revising their program and their methods, the Utah elders blamed the Protestant clergy and the perceived traits of the Hawaiian people: indolence, backwardness, and licentiousness. I never even dreamed of seeing so lifeless a race as are those with whom my lot is at present cast, wrote one elder on Hawaii. Another wrote, many, I believe, embraced the work at the commencement because it was something strange and new, a thing which this people are very fond of. Others calculated this was a church without money and without price. When they came to find the elders do actually have to eat, drink, and wear clothing, it caused some to return to the pit from whence they were dug. Others sigh for the days of Kamehameha I, when they were permitted to act out their heathenish rites, bow down to wood and stone, idols made by their own hands. In January 1857, Joseph F. Smith wrote, whoredoms and abominations of the darkest hue are mere bywords among them. Yet the unlimited practice of wickedness is inevitable, owing to the nature of their laws and hereditary habits and customs. By March 1855, it was reported, quote, but few of the saints are living their religion. Many have apostatized, not being able to forsake their filthy and abominable ways. By September of 1857, Brigham Young had all but given up on the mission. The reports from the Sandwich Islands have for a number of years agreed in one thing, he wrote newly appointed mission president Henry Bigler, and that is that the majority of saints on these islands have either been dead or are dying spiritually. It would appear that they occasionally spasmodically resuscitate for a moment, only to sink lower than they were before. You had better wind up the whole business and return with most of the elders as soon as possible. Later, Young amended his directive to include all Utah elders. The mission was to be abandoned altogether. Everyone agreed it had been a failure. From April to October 1857, only 3 new members were baptized on Oahu, while 24 were excommunicated and 9 died. There were still 371 members of record, quote, but few of them alive to their religion and many of them dead, the officers as well as members. It is like preaching to the walls, Henry Bigler concluded. There is not 10 good members. All have dwindled away and withered up, and they are now as dead limbs, not having been severed from the tree. So on October 6, 1857, most of the Mormon missionaries sailed away, the last 4 following a few months later. In their wake, they left perhaps 4,000 disillusioned inhabitants of a savaged paradise who had dared to believe, if only for a moment, that God had meant to rescue them from death and restore their people to their rightful place in His earthly and eternal kingdom. And death grinned his ghastly smile as Beelzebub intoned, waste his whole creation, or seduce that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works. Thank you.
The it's not an easy paper to respond to. It's very interesting. It's horrible in many respects. And so what I think I want to try to do is to look at the early Hawaiian mission from different perspectives at the same time. It's interesting. I mean, I'd forgotten that I knew something about this. And the reason I knew something about this is that I have, through family, and first edition copy of a book called My First Mission by George Q. Cannon, signed by him, which I got just through family. And I remember a long time ago reading that, and I didn't remember anything about a smallpox epidemic, and I again read it, and there isn't anything in it about the smallpox epidemic is the answer. But it is interesting, because during this period of time, from 1850 to 1857, you had 2 men who became extraordinarily controversial, extremely important, who served as young men their first missions in Hawaii. Those were George Q. Cannon, who a lot of people believe is probably the most influential Mormon from the last quarter of the 19th century, and Joseph F. Smith, who was almost certainly the most influential Mormon from the first quarter of the 20th century. Both of them served missions in Hawaii. I think Joseph F. Smith was 15, 16 years old when he went. George Q. Cannon was in his early 20s. John Hyde Jr., who was called as a missionary to replace some others in 1856 and met with George Q. Cannon in San Francisco as he went on the voyage from San Francisco to Honolulu, basically apostatized from the church while he's on the trip. The Book of Mormon and the LDS Gospel in Hawaii, he quite openly attacked it. The interesting thing about John Hyde Jr., which I'm one of the few people to know this, is that later when he went back to England, when it was a Swedenborgian minister, he'd been married in Utah. He married an old sweetheart of his who they'd joined the church together, and he wanted to get divorced because she had stayed back in Utah. And in fact, Heber C. Kimball from the Tabernacle Pulpit had asked the congregation to join with him in cutting John Hyde Jr. off root and branch from the LDS Church, which they all voted to do. Anyway, Hyde was back in England. He wanted to divorce his wife, presumably to remarry. And so England in the early 1850s had passed its first divorce law. This is all just a totally tangent, and I'm sorry. And He tried to take advantage of the Divorce Act of the early 1850s, and the court ruled in what has become the leading case in all of Anglo-American common law. It's a case called Hyde versus Hyde and Woodmansee, that John Hyde Jr. could not divorce his wife because he had been married in a place where plural marriage was practiced, and therefore, as the English courts define marriage, he had, for the divorce law, had never been married, although for other purposes he couldn't remarry because he was married in another sense. And literally, that English legal journals to this day, I mean, Hyde versus Hyde and Woodmansee was overruled in the 1970s by an act of Parliament, but even today, the English legal scholars still talk about. Anyway, that's totally an aside, but John Hyde Jr. sort of left the church and decided to divorce his wife on his way to Hawaii to be a missionary for the Mormon Church. You know, there's really little doubt, and Scott makes this point very effectively, that oftentimes Western society has had horrible effect on Native populations. Certainly, you know, you see it in the American Indians, you see it in Hawaiian, you see it in Native cultures. What's interesting is, although it's probably sort of a paternalistic attitude that he expressed, George Buchanan said the same thing when he wrote My First Mission, which he wrote in the early 1880s, and admittedly it's sort of a propaganda tract. It's an inspirational piece trying to induce young Mormon boys to go on missions. But what he says is, in there he said, like our Indian race, the Sandwich Islander is being destroyed and blotted from the face of the earth by too much of what is called in Babylon civilization. And I think that's really true. What he probably didn't recognize, and as Scott understands, and has helped us understand better, some of that civilization, which may not necessarily have been helpful to Native Hawaiian cultures, was the Mormon missionaries. It is interesting, though, and I'll take, again, from this book, because it's about all I know, other than what I've read from Scott's paper, and that is, I don't think all the missionaries viewed the Hawaiians necessarily, you know, in a bad light. And again, this is written 25 years after with a very specific purpose in mind. But George Buchanan, I think, at least as he tells it, and who knows whether that's correct or not, did do or tried to do some of the things that were right. I mean, he very clearly understood that it was that he needed to go out and learn to speak Hawaiian, which he did, and he learned it well enough that he's the one who translated the Book of Mormon into Hawaiian with the help of his educated Hawaiian friends. He talks a lot about learning to like poi. I mean, to pray, he had to pray to learn to like, you know, poi and fish, sort of the native diet. But he said, you know, that he still ate it when he came back to Utah when he could get it. He learned to like it well enough. That is something. He went and lived among the Hawaiians, and that is something which I think is something that should have been done. It's really interesting because there's a lot of emphasis in discussing Native Polynesian cultures, and I know that my grandfather was a missionary in the 1890s for 3 or 4 years in Tahiti, and then he went back later as a mission president, and he never said this to my dad, but others said this to my dad. They said, you know, you have to be very careful as a white Utah Mormon, as a missionary in Polynesian cultures, because if you tell the natives not to commit adultery, they say, you know, that's great because they've got, you know, 25 or 30 different concepts dealing with what Mormons would consider sexual sin. And if you say one, you know, that's fine because you still got another 24, 25 to take care of or to do. And you know, so from our sort of white perspective, I mean, I think a lot of Polynesian cultures traditionally were very sexually liberal. But one thing that really struck me in rereading Cannon's first mission, about his first mission, was that he says, you know, well, let me read it to you. It's kind of interesting. He says, there's one remarkable feature of the Hawaiian character which I will here note. Among all the races of white men of which I have yet heard where the gospel is preached, the practice of sin and especially with the other sex, is attended with the loss of the spirit. And unless there is deep and heartfelt repentance, such sinners are apt to become enemies of the truth and are frequently bitter in their opposition to the work of God and his servants. Not so with the Hawaiians. So far as my observation extended, it is true that by indulging in sin they would lose the spirit. That could be plainly seen, but I never saw that bitter apostate feeling among them which is so common among white men who apostatize. They were not given over to the spirit of unbelief as other races are. This difference struck me, and I account for it in two ways. And this is where it gets starting getting a little paternalistic, I think. It says, first, because of their ignorance, the Lord does not hold them to so strict an accountability as he does us. And second, they are the seed of Israel, and to them peculiar promises have been made. I believe the same characteristics will be found among the Lamanites, but that can be better told by those who've had experience in laboring among them. So he basically says, yeah, from our perspective, they sin sexually, but you know, somehow with them, it doesn't seem to affect them, their faith or their belief as much. It is interesting, early in the, right at when the Hawaiian mission was begun in 1850, it was very difficult for a lot of people. A lot of the original missionaries went home or went on to other islands. A few remained, and I think those that remained, at least initially, really tried to get... They first understood, as Scott said, they were to preach to the white people, to the merchant classes or the foreign merchant classes. Some of them soon understood that that was going nowhere, that the native cultures were as much children of God as anyone else as the merchant class, and that they should take the gospel to them. And you know, I guess even from 2020 hindsight, I view that the way that some of them did it in trying to really get involved with the natives for what they believed was a high calling was something to be is laudable at a certain level. This is what George Buchanan said about Hawaii. He said, the soul of a Sandwich Islander is as precious in the sight of the Lord as the soul of a white man, whether born in America or Europe. Jesus died for one as much as the other, and to the men of redskins, the Lord's promises are very great and precious. Those who administer ordinances of salvation to them will have fully as great joy over them in the day of the Lord Jesus as if they had been more enlightened. Now, you know, that's kind of interesting, because on the one hand he says, yep, you know, they're children of God too, and if only they were a little more enlightened, then maybe they'd be even better off. And so it's kind of an interesting view. It is that he does not... He was on Maui most of the time, which I don't think was hit as hard by the smallpox epidemic. Yeah, and then... But you'd think, being there nevertheless, that he would have discussed that, and he doesn't say a word about it in his account of the mission, which I find very strange. The other thing that's interesting is that these three educated Hawaiians that he got to know, the first one, Napel, actually did eventually visit Utah, and at least by George Buchanan's account, remained in the church. What's really interesting is that he says the other two are still, quote-unquote, members of the church. And I guess what that... And I think Scott knows much better, that they were... may well have been listed on the rolls of the church, as many, many people are listed on the rolls of the church. I don't think it... It probably says more that he said they are still members of the church and didn't say anything more that they weren't. At any rate, I think Scott has done us all a great service by examining this instance of sort of the culture clash between the Mormon missionaries, Western society, including the Mormon missionaries, and the native society of Hawaii. It was interesting, when I first read it, I thought, you know, now, did they really have vaccinations then? So, of course, I had to go to the library and learn about about the cowpox, the development of the cowpox vaccination. And, in fact, smallpox has been effectively treated for years, although when it's been introduced to places, there has often been opposition, and not everyone, you know, we're talking 18th, 19th centuries here, not everyone would readily accept it. And, for example, a lot of people died in Boston in the 18th century in a smallpox epidemic, even though they could have been inoculated because they didn't trust the process. But it's certainly true that vaccination was effective. I guess smallpox was probably the original effective vaccination in the medical world. And as I say, I think we should all join in thanking Scott for sharing this with us, because it really is an interesting interlude in both the history of Hawaii and in the history of the Mormon Church. Thank you.
So we have 4 minutes left on some questions.
The question would be, when was the mission reestablished and were there more fortunate results? And the second question would be, when did the attitude towards seeking the administrations of physical medicine change so as not to regard it as a loss of faith or an absence of faith?
Walter Murray Gibson, the famous adventurer, approached Brigham Young in about 1860 or so, wanted to go off to the South Seas. I think to Tahiti was his original plan, and conned Brigham into giving him Gibson a large, impressive-looking parchment with all kinds of ribbons on it and so forth to impress the natives, that said that he was a representative of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and everyone should pay attention to him. And he took that and was just sort of bouncing around and wound up in Honolulu, where he found out about the Mormons, that there were Mormons out there. And so he went to Lanai. He got some people, got some money, and got some land on Lanai, where the Mormon colony had existed for a short period of time in 1854-55, and gathered all the Mormons. He was quite a talker, and he started selling priesthood offices and doing all kinds of strange things, calling it Mormonism. And when Brigham Young found out about it, in a year or two later, he dispatched Joseph F. Smith and Lorenzo Snow and Ezra T. Benson and I think several others to get things settled. And they went over and excommunicated Gibson and then bought some land at Laie, where they then encouraged the people to go. And they set up a sugar plantation there eventually, and that was the beginnings of the Mormonism again on the Hawaiian Islands. The other question was about priesthood administration and what?
When resorting to physical medicine, when was it more permissible to resort to physical medicine and not to be seen as an evidence of a lack of faith in administration of the sick?
Oh, has that happened?
Not in Utah County.
Well, maybe I just live in Utah. Any other questions? Comments? Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks, Scott and Ken, for sharing this very interesting chapter in Mormon history that I think very few of us ever do anything about.